You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 154.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have reached another Local Maximum. This is a co-hosted show, of course, today, joined by Aaron. How you doing today?
Heidi ho, neighbors.
That's a new one.
I saw a Simpsons meme today, so it's floating around in the back of my head.
Okay. Where are we going to start today? Oh, my God. So let's start with the decentralization episode from last week, because I was surprised at how much of a positive feedback I got. You know, sometimes I listen to all these other podcasters and all these other creators, whether it's on Locals or somewhere else, and like they're on fire, and I'm like, wow, this guy's putting together. And I sort of, rounded up the news stories and gave some good reporting, but I wasn't like, I was a little bit disjointed. So I'm glad that people, saw the value in that.
Well, I think everyone's been a little disjointed in the last 7 to 10 days. It's been interesting times.
Yeah. So I just want to follow up on that story, because there's obviously, in terms of like the decentralization of the internet, which is a slow moving, 10-15 year story, as we'll get to in a little bit. But now this week is the time, like things are moving very fast. And so I got, I saw a bunch of messages on Twitter from Anthony Pompliano, at Pomp, I think. And he writes a lot about Bitcoin. He's a big Bitcoin investor. And, he gave he also really believes that the decentralization decade is coming. He went through like the bed of the 1990s was the internet. The bed of the 2010s is mobile and cloud and some social. And the bed of the 2020s will be decentralization. And I thought, yes. And this really goes along well with the kind of the classification system that Chris Dixon gave, which was 1990 to 2005 web, decentralized web, 2005 to 2020 big tech web, Facebook, Google, all that, and then 2020 to presumably 2035 is the decentralized era, or at least that's when we'll be building it. I assume we don't get to enjoy the fruits of it so much until the end of the era, although many people are already enjoying the fruits of Bitcoin, to be sure.
Yeah, and I guess we've seen a bit of chatter in the local as well with responses to that your last show. I think particularly around, was it Mastodon, and people checking that out?
Yes. Some people are checking out Mastodon, which is the alternative to Twitter. I have not personally been able to get really into it yet, but I think it's interesting, like just because I can't get into it. Well, then again, I don't tweet that much. So it's like, so maybe I'm not the person to get started. Now I'm just putting my random thoughts. I'll go on Locals maybe. So you all can get them on maximum.locals.com to connect with me directly. But I think that I'm sort of starting to learn about it, because if I've learned one thing about like valuing startups, and I know Mastodon isn't a startup, it's a collection, but it's like growth matters, and the growth has been tremendous. Hmm. Are we still allowed to say tremendous? That's going to be a problem. No, but it has been.
It's been hugely tremendous.
Oh, no. That's clearly out.
Bridge too far.
Yeah.
So I am not yet on Mastodon, but much like you, I've been putting things that previously I might have sent directly to you as a private conversation. I've been sharing some of those thoughts over on the local as well. So
good.
I'm glad to see that some of our listeners have been chiming in on some of those topics as well.
I'm surprised, because pleasantly surprised, because I had a Facebook group for the whole time, and nobody ever said anything on the Facebook group. So there's something about this Locals where it's like, it's just us or just the Locals that you subscribe to that is very interesting.
I would be very curious to see how many of the members of the maximum.locals.com are also members of other locals, or if you, if we are the participation that has brought them to the platform, because I think that may have been part of the problem over on the Facebook side, is that there's so much other stuff going on that maybe they add you to their feed, but you get drowned out in all the noise there.
Right, especially since my feed was just announcing new episodes, sure. which I do on locals, but you know, it's there's more no than random thoughts on the feed. Yeah. Okay, so another follow-up, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey defends banning Trump as the right decision, but he says that he wants to work on a crypto version of Twitter, and he's calling it Blue Sky. And so he says, this is going to be the decentralized Twitter, and then we're going to put Twitter on top of it. And so I haven't found too much specifics on how Blue Sky would work. There's one article in, I believe it's Metro saying that, you know, it's they're trying to make it more blockchain-y. It's modeled on Bitcoin, whereas, you know, Mastodon is just decentralized. It's not a blockchain. But it's the Mastodon developers are skeptical. They kind of think Dorsey is working on something that's competing with them, and that he, so in order for him to have control over, but he also said that, hey, I just appointed a small team of five people to do this, and they have complete freedom to identify and use existing technology. But also in another interview with Jack Dorsey that came out today, he said that Twitter needs to stamp down harder on you know, some of the conspiracy theories and whatnot on Twitter. So which maybe is not necessarily inconsistent with wanting to build this freer platform, but maybe it is. I don't know.
Yeah,
he's giving mixed messages.
I would be very interested to see something that is blockchain based, because presumably that would mean that you can't censor
uncensorable.
It because once it goes up there, it's there. You can't alter it.
Right. Even Mastodon can basically you can collude and censor I think theoretically.
Yeah. But it's very much buzzword bingo at this point, since we don't know what's actually going on under the hood here. But the idea of having a uncensorable layer, and then sit on top of that, you have your Twitter interface, which among its features could be a filter to filter out all the stuff they view as objectionable, and you could use this this viewer, this interface, to view that blockchain, or you could have some other viewer interface that, you know, maybe it's via Gab or Parler or something that's hooked into the same blockchain but has a different set of filtering criteria. And you've talked about having competing filter models as a solution to some of these problems before. That this might be a way to operationalize that vision.
Yeah, I mean, I
don't have high faith in Twitter being the one to do that properly, but
I like the
idea.
Some people might like it. If you're happy with the way Twitter is filtering,
if you like your Twitter, you can keep it.
Yeah. In some ways, they don't filter. Like, if you go to if you go to your Twitter feed, it might be okay if you follow, you know, the people you want to follow. But when you look up their news items on the right, then it's all just like it's all just like the whole random bunch, and it's just like you get your news item, and then below it, it's just a bunch
trending.
It's just a bunch of crap. Like the people who are commenting on it. So that feature is kind of broken, I think. So you also see these alternative social platforms. Another one is MeWe, that are just starting to shoot up to the App Store. It's like every day another one is shooting up. I haven't seen anything like this for a long time. The App Store has been stable for many years and had been considered saturated. So this is very interesting development.
Yeah, and you know, Parler was shooting to the top of the list for a while until they got deep sixed or torpedoed, or however you want to put it. So I'm curious how long MeWe is going to be able to ride this wave before either outside influence or their own stumbling causes them to topple. Because
I think even if
they don't screw something up or get torpedoed, they can't stay at the top of that store forever. Something's going to happen.
Sure. Sure. And it's not like, they need an excuse to get rid of you. With Parler kind of handed them excuses and also made themselves vulnerable to it. So I think a lot of these other platforms are seeing, okay, we have to have a game plan if they do X, Y, and Z to us. And I think they're also seeing, hey, you know, this is how we can kind of tamp down on some of the crazier stuff on our platform to make it less likely for this to happen, but and yet still be independent of what these other groups are doing, of what the big tech companies are doing.
And having those backup plans is certainly sensible. And anyone in this space who isn't doing that is you know, committing malfeasance at this point, because we know it's a real risk. But there's definitely a case to be made for prior restraint coming into play here, that if they think that the results of unrestricted speech or less restricted speech could be this deplatforming, then they're going to be incentivized to exercise more censorship. And is that desirable or not? I suppose there's a discussion to be had there.
I think they'll just go to they'll just do the bare minimum, kind of. It's you know, they won't do what Twitter's doing, which is, I mean, there's been like a massive deplatforming of tons of people. Somehow I'm still standing. I haven't lost users, but I see a lot of people.
I wonder how much of it is there is an actual line that you can go up to, but if you cross it, then you're in trouble. Versus whoever the one that furthest to I hate to put this in terms of left and right, but you know, just assume a spectrum here, and whoever is, you know, the furthest to one side of the spectrum, they're going to get lopped off, no matter where the line is actually drawn. And once they're gone, well, then the next person up is on the chopping block. So, you know, maybe. Now that Parler is
but who's the next one?
Contention,
I don't know.
Does that make MeWe the next on the chopping block? And is there anything they can do?
I haven't, other
than shifting themselves far enough in the other direction that somebody else is now the nail that sticks up.
Yeah.
I don't have a good answer to that. Just I'm kind of trying to get a sense of what the real landscape is out there. That being said, I'm not on any of these platforms, so I don't have a good sense of what's really going on the platform itself, or if it should be a victim or subject to these types of actions.
MeWe to me just seems like a clean Facebook at this point. I haven't seen any crazy stuff on it. Actually, some of the groups I was in on Facebook have migrated over to MeWe, and it seems like they are less vitriolic on MeWe than they ever were on Facebook.
Yeah, I've heard of a bunch of groups actually starting pretty early in 2020 shifting over to MeWe, mostly because key members of the group were getting repeated bans, and so it wasn't worth it for them to try and fight it and stick it out.
Interesting.
They decided to move camp.
I think it was more like Facebook started harassing the group owners and like asking
exactly. That's what I mean.
So I mean it, but it's interesting that like I've been on a bunch of Facebook groups, and every once in a while these Nazis come on and try to Nazi it up.
Now,
and
when
I
you
haven't
say Nazis,
seen that.
Do you mean like literal white supremacist anti-Semitic, or are we talking, you know, like grammar Nazis, but not just grammar, but you know that kind of vitriol in some other field?
Let's just say like it was like literal. I hate the term literal Nazi now. But it was like,
I wouldn't expect would use the term as, generic a-hole substitute. You're using it a little bit more specifically than that.
No, yeah. In some of the more open groups on Facebook, I've seen those crop in. And even if they weren't Nazis, they were whatever, racist or whatever. And really racist, not just. But like MeWe, I haven't seen that yet. So I mean, maybe it's just my experience, but that I find that very interesting. How Facebook has gotten so ugly, and that nobody talks about it. All right, so I want to talk about a product that I'm just starting to look into, but I want to check out, and I want to tell you about. It's called Knowable. What's an NBA All-Star? Chris Paul, NASA Commander Scott Kelly, and Reddit co-founder Alexis Ohanian have in common. They all have incredible experiences and have created audio courses to teach you what they've learned. They're on Knowable, a new app where the world's top experts teach new skills in bite-sized audio courses. They're short like a podcast, like this one, although this one's not that short. sometimes. They're expert-led like an audiobook and 100% ad-free. NASA Commander Scott Kelly teaches lessons learned from a career in space. NBA All-Star Chris Paul discusses the performance benefits of a plant-based lifestyle. Reddit co-founder Alexis Ohanian teaches how to launch a startup. And over 100 other experts are waiting to teach you something new. Are you ready to learn something new today? Download the Knowable app or visit knowable.fyi and use the code MAX for an additional 20% off, and I think it's $50 a month. So that's not $50 a month, $50 a year. Big difference. So I think you're good with that. Yeah, no. So we've got an affiliate here, and I'm excited to get started with it. There are definitely some lessons that I want to dive into. I'm going to dive into it personally and tell you about it on the show in the next couple weeks. I know, Aaron, you probably have a few things on your list, but I haven't
listened to any of them yet, but I've already got Scott Kelly's Go for Launch course on my short list, along with about a half a dozen other courses that I want to take a look at and check out. So hopefully I'll be able to report back more on those in the near future.
All right. Exciting. So there'll be a link that you could use on localmaxradio.com/154 to check it out. Or you could just go to knowable.fyi and use promo code MAX. All right. Another quote that I saw, I think this was from Anthony Pompliano, I'm not sure. So the crypto version of any project ends up being a lot more valuable. Now, that's a little bit, it's a little bit interesting because people sort of conflate the crypto, like a blockchain project, and a decentralized project like Mastodon. They're not really the same thing, but they sort of have the same idea. And obviously a blockchain project is something you set in motion, you can't stop. So that's like the most secure.
Blockchain by its very nature is decentralized, I think.
It's a subset.
But not all decentralized projects must use blockchain.
Exactly. All right. So all of these stories that we're talking about, we're going to continue to follow them, as we come back every week on the Local Maximum, maybe not every week, but it seems like in the near future, a lot of weeks. I always feel like when you go through times like this, it'll be interesting to think, like, what are we going to think about this 5 years from now, 10 years from now? Or we make these kinds of forecasts about blockchain technology, about decentralized technology. What's going to come true 10 years from now? What are we going to get wrong? And I feel like since we try to project out so many years, you also kind of have to go back and look at past projections that people have made a long time ago. And so I wanted to talk about this video. This is a viral video that came out in 2004. Now, there was no YouTube at the time, so how do you have a viral video?
I was just going to ask when YouTube came along, because I didn't think it was there at the time.
No, it wasn't there yet, but it was I don't know how it went viral, but it was something that was like going around the internet. I don't know how it was.
Well, and it was Flash, which interestingly enough, we're recording on the 14th of January. So 14 days ago, Flash was officially depreciated on the internet. It stopped working.
Oh, but the videos are now available on YouTube.
Yes. So yeah. Okay. They've been ported over, but the original no longer works because of that.
Okay. So this video is called Epic 2014. And then there's another one, Epic 2015, where they just added an extra, a few extra sentences, an extra year. And so this was kind of, from the standpoint of 2004, and they were trying to project out the next 10 years of media on the internet. So it was a presentation given to the Poynter Institute of Media Studies in Tampa, Florida. So they were talking to media people about how technology is coming for you and how it's going to change your world. Of course, it did. Now this same institute runs Fact Checker PolitiFact, which didn't exist in 2004. So they are now part of the Borg, as they say. So they tried to predict the future of what we now called big tech, and they had a lot to say on news and blogging and journalism. And we want to see how they did. So again, 2004, Facebook was a small college thing. I was on Facebook. Maybe it was going around Facebook a little bit. No iPhones, no YouTube, no Twitter, not a lot of text messaging. They talked a lot about Friendster, actually, which was the proto Facebook. So they, when they say, well, Friendster will do this and Friendster will do that, you can kind of think,
I'm surprised
well,
they didn't Facebook. Even mention MySpace, because I think it was around at that point, right? Or
yeah, it would have been.
Or did it come along after that? I know it predated Facebook, right?
Yeah, yeah. I feel like MySpace, like people in the media were still using it as the dominant social network in like 2010. When in 2010, like Facebook was clearly the dominant one. Like the people are a few years behind on that stuff.
Well, you have to remember that people in the media, there was a long stretch where it was only really available and used by people who were in college. So even though it had grown across the country and across the world, it was very much a college kid thing.
Until like
not a professional
2007.
Thing.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so let's talk about what they said. Let's actually open up let's listen to the beginning of this, just the first minute of this video.
Okay.
It is the best of times. It is the worst of times. In the year 2015, people have access to a breadth and depth of information unimaginable in an earlier age. Everyone contributes in some way, participating to create a living, breathing mediascape. However, the press as you know it has ceased to exist. The Fourth Estate's fortunes have waned. 20th century news organizations are an afterthought, a lonely remnant of a not too distant past.
Okay, so that from the standpoint of 2004. And just in broad terms, I think maybe it wasn't that hard to see, but seeing the total disruption of the press was certainly, it is nothing like it looked, 20 years ago.
Yeah. And so I assume that most of the facts that they had up to 2004 were pretty on the dot, things like Google buying Blogger, they mentioned happening in 2003.
Right.
I haven't fact checked that, but I'm assuming that
that's
until they got to the future part, they didn't alter the timeline.
Right. So they mentioned, Google buying Keyhole, which was kind of the key to
Picasa,
Google Earth's images. Yeah. Which, does that still exist or is just Google Photos?
I think
now?
It's just Google Photos now.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, then they come up with right. They have the timeline of the internet up to 2004. And remember, in terms of the Chris Dixon thing, this is 2004 is around the time when we're switching from the decentralized net to the big tech net, and then now is the time where we're kind of switching back. So they're kind of talking about this big 15-year, I know they're doing 10 years, but they're talking about just to fit it in with like kind of Chris Dixon's timeline. They're sort of fitting it into this big 15-year block of consolidation of media in web technology. And basically, it's interesting because the outcome they're talking about is the outcome we're in now that we're kind of sliding out of. So it's so that's where we are. Okay.
Well, if
so
we are sliding out of it.
If we're sliding out of it, right. So they talk about, they think Microsoft's going to buy Friendster. And it's interesting because Microsoft did invest heavily in Facebook. But when you talk about the social apps, they did see social coming, but they used Friendster as a.
Well, and they now own LinkedIn, I believe.
Microsoft owns LinkedIn.
There's something very, very Microsoft about. Like, if IBM or Microsoft were to own a social network, obviously it would be LinkedIn. It's like the most suit and tie version of a social network you could come up with.
Right. Okay. And they also talk about, they say, okay, in a few years, Google is going to come up with this thing called the Google Grid. Now, I'm trying to wrap my heads around what their version of the Google Grid was and then what actually happened. But it kind of sounds like a Facebook, Twitter, with really good privacy controls. Like they're like, and everybody will have privacy controls. And I'm like, yeah, it's not as good.
I think the way they talk about it and the visual that goes with it, it's basically that all your data goes here, all of it. And you can pick and choose what is, you know, privately stored and only visible to you. And you can pick what to publish, and you can, they don't talk about publishing it to different groups. So it's unclear whether that's a, you know, there's it's kind of a binary private versus global setting or not, but basically that all your data is going to be with them. And it's also giving you the power to share it with everybody else.
Right. So it's, and there was Google Buzz that maybe was a little bit like this as well. I think we did an episode called the Google Graveyard.
Yep.
Do you remember that one? Which is, I'm trying to, let me see if I can get the,
well, yeah, there was Google Buzz, there was Google Plus, there was Google Reader, and those all kind of moved close to that area, but none of them fully materialized into this, what they're calling the Google Grid.
Episode 36. So the Google Grid can almost be thought of as all of social media today, I think. And so, you know, they have that coming about in 2006, in 2008. With Microsoft. In reality, it took a lot longer for those things to come to fruition. So they talked about Microsoft sorting news socially with their new Friendster acquisition. Really, it ends up being Facebook sorting news socially and Twitter sorting news socially with comments for everybody. So what they're talking about sounds very Facebook Twitter-like. But of course, I feel like they also had, you know, a lot of stuff about Google writing news articles using AI, which, you know, does happen quite a bit. But their description of like writing a different article for each user was that's clearly not something.
Yeah,
that
they didn't have that happening until 2010 after the merger, which I guess. I buried the lead there.
Oh, did I skip ahead in the timeline?
Well, with that super synthesized news, yes.
Yeah. Okay. But sorry.
So popping back for a second to what was it that happened in 2006 when they come out with the Google Grid? The other thing they mention is that Google consolidates all of its businesses or all of its products into this Google Grid, and that made me think about when did Google become Alphabet? And apparently that was in 2015. But even now, five plus years later, they haven't. Alphabet is just kind of a parent company, a holding company. It's not like all of those projects and programs and sub companies under it have truly merged into one mega beast. It's more that it's a hydra with many heads rather than, you know, one giant mecha Godzilla, and I'm mixing my monster metaphors there, but
right, they predict the 2008 merger of Google and Amazon, and that's why it's called the Googlezon video. So they're like, and they make Googlezon, you know, but, and that never happened, but those companies are incredibly symbiotic. Amazon is Google's biggest advertiser, you know, that makes sense, you know, because they have lots of products advertised, they have the most information, and Google is Amazon's biggest source of traffic,
and presumably Google Search is somehow rolled into the Amazon product, I would expect.
In the fictional world that they're creating, or the real world?
They mention back in 2004 Amazon launching A9, which I think was a real thing using Google Search. I don't know to what extent Google Search is used inside of the Amazon ecosystem today.
Right. And of course, back then, Amazon didn't get into cloud computing yet, which now they're in. So now they control half the internet.
The Google Grid, I certainly visualize it as a cloud, but there's nothing in here that predicts cloud computing necessarily.
Right. I mean, I think back then you sort of, like, you can sort of see that's basically what they're talking about, even though that's not what they called it back then.
And part of that is that the cloud is a weird metaphor that we use.
Yeah.
The cloud is really just a fancy way of saying putting your stuff on other people's computers. There's nothing special about it being the cloud.
Right. It's, I mean, Yeah, exactly. The cloud, and you kind of think of the cloud as it's almost like a metaphor for centralization, where I'm not going to keep things locally. I'm going to keep things in. Now, Amazon is not a central location. Like, if you upload something to Amazon servers, it could be anywhere. It could be broken up into many different pieces, but it's centrally controlled.
Right.
They
physically
have,
distributed, but logically right. Centralized.
So they have this Googlezon company, this mega tech company that merged in 2008, create user profiles of all of us. Interestingly enough, they used Winston Smith as the example user profile, who is
paging George Orwell.
The protagonist of 1984, which is a book that has been discussed many times these days, that I think a lot more people are saying, hey, George Orwell's book 1984 describes this time than they were saying it in 2005, 2004. There's certainly some parallels you could find back then, but not nearly as much. Like, I remember, that's actually when I read it, and I remember thinking, oh, wow, this is an interesting book, interesting academic exercise. I don't really find it that relevant to my life. And then
fools,
15 years later. Yeah, then 15 years later, like, oh, wow, actually there's a lot of stuff that's relevant.
And that's at least the second literary reference that we get in the video, because in the opening bit, I think the clip that you played, we get the opening lines of A Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. I'm not sure quite what to read in from that, but definitely some literary references buried in here.
The people who made the video are well-read. That's what I read it to. I mean, I'm sure they were trying to say there's some truth to that too, right?
That was the time of revolution. Was it not? The French Revolution?
Yeah.
I presume because like the guy was being held in the Bastille. It's been a long time since I've read that.
2020 and 2021 are probably not the best of times, but I think you could almost say that about maybe 2018 is the best of times, the worst of times. Everyone's great. But I think once we come out of this pandemic, if the economy's good, it'll again be the best of times and the worst of times at the same time if we don't fix what's going on with our technology. So I do see how that line kind of works.
Other thing they called out happening in 2008 was the New York Times moving to a paid online only subscription model. Which they haven't moved to online only, but they are leaning much more heavily today into the online subscription mode.
I have an online subscription with them. I don't know if I should advertise that, but I do, and that's basically what they. Well, I don't know. I don't know where most of their revenue comes from. I assume it comes from the online subscriptions more than the papers, but I could be wrong.
That would be interesting to see what their breakdown is.
Yeah. Okay, but it's definitely a much bigger deal. Like, if you remember back to 2004, I don't think there were papers that were doing online, online subscriptions.
It's tough to remember back then. I feel like you probably could get an online subscription to the New York Times at that point, but it was so that you could do like the crossword puzzle. Print out the crossword puzzle. Not that you were realistically only using it online, or if you were, that certainly wasn't the bulk of their.
I don't think they had their articles behind the paywall either. So there was that too.
I remember creating an account when I was in college so that I could read articles online, but I definitely wasn't paying anything to do it.
Right. Interesting. And now they have the New York Times archive, which is fantastic. You can go back and read anything since like 1851.
That's kind of mind blowing that what you used to have to go to a library and dig out, stacks and stacks of microfiche, you can do with a touch of the keyboard from your own home today.
Yeah. I kind of wish other newspapers had that, like the New York Post or whatever, because you realize the New York Post is such an old paper in New York and it's changed viewpoints multiple times. I'd kind of be interested to see like what it had to say in like 1983 or something.
Yeah, I'm sure that like the Library of Congress probably has an archive of it, but it maybe isn't fully digitized and searchable by the public at this point. I wonder how the copyright and that kind of thing works for that.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get back to the video and what they predict. They predict kind of this master algorithm where Google uses natural language processing to take facts available on a given day and presents this to us in a personalized way so we each get the most relevant news.
Yeah, so that's going a level beyond what we currently get, which is picking out the news stories and articles and headlines that you might be interested in reading and literally breaking it down, you know, on a fact-by-fact, sentence-by-sentence basis and then remixing it for you personally, which
it does
we haven't
a little
seen
bit,
that
but not...
level of intelligence being applied to. I'm sure you could do a deep learning approach to this, but I'm kind of afraid of what it would spit out.
Well, right. Like you could say, okay, train GPT-3 to work with individually. Well, GPT-3 doesn't really. Yeah, it seems like a lot of work to get an outcome that, you know, might not have any tangible benefit to try to have a different writing style for each user. But I understand what that means. And so I understand the idea of personalized news is obviously what Twitter and Facebook and all of these companies were advertising, what they were trying to do. Although I don't think we really get personalized news anymore. I feel like we get news that these companies choose for us, essentially.
We basically get to choose which echo chambers to subscribe to. And in that sense, it's personalized, but it's not really personalized to you. It's that you've chosen which reality to subscribe to.
But I also think that it's beyond that. Like these companies do actually decide, you know, you can go into an echo chamber, but they do kind of decide what you see within that echo chamber, and they do tip their hand on the scales more than you would expect.
Sure, and that's not necessarily new. It's just that the editorial power is shifting a little bit here.
Right. So I think they were way, way too optimistic about AI. I think a lot of these large language models are still in the works, and you know, it's possible that some of this will never come to fruition. But I don't think it will because they call it out specifically
as AI, but that definitely seems to be what they're talking about there.
Right. And I think that, but there's been such tremendous progress in the field of language models and, you know, pulling out facts and stuff like that. You know, just listen to the episode on GPT-3 and all that and what Google's doing. It's probably... something like this is probably coming, although it's the thing about natural language is that it always takes longer than expected. I feel like that's going back to like the 50s where they thought they could model language with the 60s with the technology they had then, and it just wasn't possible.
Was this the Dartmouth conference or?
I'm not sure.
I feel like there was some famous meeting for AI that happened at Dartmouth, and they all got together and basically said, you know, based on what we know, we think it'll take, you know, a couple of grad students like 6 months to solve this problem. And then they went off and it still hasn't been solved today.
Oh, I'd like to find that.
I'll have to do some research and see if I can find exactly what I'm talking about there. I might be mixing up some apocryphal stories from the world of AI.
All right. No, I think that sounds about right. All right. And so then they finally get to 2014. They predict immense advertising revenue.
We skip 2011, where the New York Times sues Google's on for copyright infringement for continuing to crawl all of their articles and basically remixing their news and loses at the Supreme Court.
Yeah. So that didn't happen.
although they're I don't know if there's certainly been conflict between news organizations and both Google and probably more so Facebook with you know, if their stuff gets posted on there, then they don't get any of the ad revenue and so on. I don't know if any of it's gone to the Supreme Court or not, but there's definitely been lawsuits thrown around in that realm.
Right.
And I think in the early days, there were some news organizations that were trying to force, I don't know if it was Google or another search engine, it was probably Google, to try and prevent them from crawling their sites because they felt that was an infringement. And I think they ended up losing that. Not clear whether they lost that in the courts or if they just came to the realization that if we don't let Google crawl us, nobody's going to go to our website.
Right. Who was that?
I don't remember the specific news organizations, but it wouldn't surprise me if it was somebody like the New York Times back in the early days.
Yeah. So they predicted 2014, the New York Times goes offline only. It's paper, print only, just for the elite and elderly. Well, that was not the fate of the New York Times. But a lot of these papers don't carry the heft that they once did. That's clearly true.
Yeah. Does Time Magazine exist anymore, or did that one
disappear? Oh, sure.
No.
It exists.
It must be Newsweek, I think, that disappeared. But there are plenty of publications that either disappeared completely or went digital only.
Yeah. I feel like there was a lot more theory that print would just go out of fashion or would just be something that nobody did. And they go on printing, and, you know, you could still go to whatever, like around here, CVS, and get all the printed newspapers, and you know, so things don't go away that quickly. Or that actually, that stuff might never go away. Honestly, even though there are some sci-fi movies. I think it was Minority Report, where, or also like Harry Potter, where somebody has a newspaper that changes.
Yep.
So it's kind of like a paper e-ink type situation. But I wouldn't. The best thing about buying a newspaper is that it's like it's disposable. You could get food on it. You could crumple it up. You can throw it out. You could use it to line a birdcage.
When the Kindle first came out, and this is something that's more or less dropped out of their bag of tricks, but a big piece of it was, oh, we can customize your news feed and have news stories, you know, from certain publications sent to your Kindle every day. Now with the newer Kindle Fires, you can have, well, because Amazon owns the Washington Post, they basically come with the Washington Post app installed there, and you can install other news apps there. So that's kind of supplanted that. But that's moving away from e-ink and towards a color tablet.
Yeah. Huh. That's interesting. I mean, we haven't really talked about display technologies on the show yet, and those tend to move pretty fast. And, you know, I would love to do an episode on that and try to, you know, learn a little bit about where they're going. Because e-ink's been around for a long time, but I haven't heard of any really cool products in the space of e-readers that have come out recently.
The foldable screens seem to keep attempting to launch and then either face planting or launching but not getting adoption. But there's
I don't know why that is, so I'd have to look at that.
We're not prepared to talk in detail about that. But let's hit the 2014 highlight here, the apotheosis, the release of Epic.
Well, first of all, they predict immense advertising revenue for Google, and that's spot on.
Yeah.
Especially in 2004, when Google really was only 6 years old and people really just starting to talk about Google in polite conversation. Like, yes, we had Google in 2001, 2002, but like back then, it was kind of like something that, you know, I knew about. It was a search engine that I found, and I wouldn't have assumed that other people would know about it. By 2004, it was clearly like everybody knows what Google is, but it was just starting.
So 2004, when this came out, I'm assuming this is accurate because it was in the real time, you know, before they started forecasting. They have Gmail coming out in 2004. And I remember getting a Gmail invite being like a hot commodity that you needed to know somebody who knew somebody to do that.
Yes. And eventually I did. And it was so exciting. And you get 1 gigabyte of free space. So, yes.
That's cool. The amount of free storage to go along with your Gmail account has not grown according to Moore's Law.
No, definitely not. I don't know how much it is, but it's not enough.
Mine tops out at, like, I think 15, and that might be because I've got some promotional bonuses in there. Not enough. Yeah. Not enough.
That's what they say. Okay, so they predict the rise of Epic in 2014.
The evolving personalized information construct.
Right.
How's that
and
for
also,
an acronym?
They used E as in, like...
Epsilon?
You know... No. E as in the constant E.
Okay.
Personalized information, pi as in PI, and construct C as in the speed of light. Okay, so contributors can get paid a fraction of ad revenue based on the popularity of their content. So that describes YouTube.
Which is a Google company.
Pretty spot on. Yeah, and it was bought by Google in 2006 for $2 billion, one of the best acquisitions of all time. Yeah. And so it was one of the best acquisitions of all time, because now that thing's worth, YouTube has got to be one of the major sources of Google's revenue. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if it was half. And contributors do get paid. And also, they predicted custom content for each user based on what the system knows of it. So, yes, again, and nowadays, a lot of that custom content is in the form of ads. And there is so much money to be made in the ad industry that that thing becomes basically as efficient as it possibly can be. It's like a living, breathing system. And even though we get dumb ads sometimes, it's amazing how sophisticated the tech underneath is. I think I'll link to the episode where I talked to Shoshana Wodinsky about the ad tech space.
So there's also a little tag on for 2015, I guess, which was their added bonus material, and they talk about an ex New York Times reporter who's tagging what they refer to as broadcasts with GPS data and other users joining in, and this sounds the first thing that popped to mind was microblogging of audio, and maybe this is a prescient view of like TikTok or maybe they were thinking something more along the lines of podcasts, but there's a kernel of something that they got there. And if they added this in 2014 or 2015, then maybe that's not that forward looking, because I mean, was Vine around then? When did that happen? And Periscope, my sense of time is all out of whack, but
that was around 2014.
Yeah. So there was stuff like this popping up then, but what was new and innovative then is newly trending again now. It's kind of come around again in the cycle.
Right. I mean, this almost reminded me of what I'm working on with Marsbot Audio,
sure.
Where you can create geofenced audio content, and you know, you walk around, and all of a sudden, someone, maybe me, comes on and starts talking to you about where you are. So. That's really, and of course it predicts in some ways Foursquare, which wouldn't start for another 5 years from when they made the video. So where you kind of broadcast your location in a check-in. So now it's not audio, but it's a very simple piece of data that could then be sent to all your friends and all that stuff. So, all right, I think we've gone through the video and everything that they've said on it. Very interesting stuff. Very cool to see what people say about essentially our time in 2004. I mean, I know their prediction was 5 years ago, but again, this was the prediction of big tech, and that's where we're in now. And so let's see if we get some final thoughts on how they did. First of all, I think they did very well. I don't think you could do much better than how they did. I think they benefited from talking to the people who were creating and evangelizing this technology. So they were actually talking. So I don't know who said like the best way to predict the future is to create it, but they were talking to the creators and the investors. And so that sort of gives me, optimism for this blockchain tech, because a lot of the people who are predicting it are also involved in creating it. So that's really encouraging. They kind of missed mobile a little bit, although a lot of this stuff can't be done without mobile. I think it was just, you know, they missed like how big of a deal it would be in terms of a business opportunity, but also as in terms of like how it changed all of our lives.
Yeah, and while they kind of missed it, they got a close but no cigar on one of those items. And actually, let's step back a second, because one of the things we skipped over that they did mention, which I think actually did happen in 2004, they talk about the iPod launching the podcast movement. And it, you know,
oh, yeah.
They refer to it as personal radio,
which,
you know, it kind of removed the gatekeeper to some extent, much in the same way that blogs did for a lot of early citizen journalism. In a pre-Twitter world, and even in a pre-Facebook world, then they forecast into what then was the very near future in 2005 what they refer to as the Apple Wi-Fi pod. The Wi-Fi pod, which was an iPod with a digital camera and built-in Wi-Fi, so you could you could share images and audio with other users without having to to plug in to connect, which is so close to getting the iPhone prediction, which didn't come out until 2007, but completely changed the landscape for a lot of tech.
Imagine if they went to Steve Jobs and they'd be like, you need to name this the Wi-Fi pod. Be like, the Wi-Fi pod, really? No, you're right. They did get some of that. And podcasting as well. I think they overestimated how much podcasting would be tied to a location, because you think like talk radio has to be tied to a location, or at least it was historically, because radio, you're usually only broadcasting to your city or 100, 200, 300 mile radius, depending on the strength of the radio signal. But now there are some local podcasts, but I think that they are less common than just general podcasts about a topic of interest.
Yeah, I mean it's a different kind of niche, but the freedom of the medium lets you pursue that, because you don't have necessarily the overhead that would be required in a more traditional approach. So you can you can cater to a very niche audience, whether that's geographically niche or niche in their interests.
Yeah, and podcasting is, I think, probably the freest medium on the internet right now that we're participating in, because it's so decentralized, somehow escaped the clutches of big tech. There are some companies like Spotify trying to get it, but so far it's been rather...
Yeah, I'm surprised, other than the only example I can think of is Alex Jones, but I'm surprised other than that we haven't heard of more people being blocked from at least the iTunes store. Or whatever they call it, the podcast, the iTunes podcast store. Because Apple is well known for taking a walled garden approach to all of their content and their services. That's where I would first expect to see some sort of censorship occurring there, rather than like your SoundClouds or some of your other hosting services.
I think it's because, a lot of podcasts are very small. They don't have the time or the resources to check into all of them, even using machine learning, I don't think they're transcribing all our podcasts. Secondly, podcasts don't have comments associated with them, so you don't see all the vitriol that's right in your face that you do on something like a Parler or Twitter or all that. There are some podcasts out there that are probably censorable. Whether it's Alex Jones censorable or like Howard Stern censorable
I know they do have the explicit tag, but I don't know whether that's user if the creator has to select that, or if they have a way of checking for that and
right. But even so, other podcatchers that they allow you to just type in an RSS feed or paste in an RSS feed. So you could actually get around all of this pretty easily.
Right. If they actually wanted to censor on that level, then they would have to not only remove it from their store, but then they would have to remove all of the other podcatcher apps from their app store, which Apple certainly has the ability to do. But that would be a pretty dramatic undertaking.
It would be very dramatic. It would kind of make people not want yeah, it would be extremely dramatic. Okay, so we covered a lot today. We covered the rising decentralization. We went back 15 years and looked at what they were saying about this particular phase of the internet and what big tech predictions of big tech and warnings of big tech that they gave us from 10 years ago. One comment that really stuck out at me was, I think it was the Google Grid. Oh, yeah, yeah. They're talking about Epic, and they said, at its worst, it's a collection of trivia, much of it untrue, narrow, shallow, and sensational. And I was like, yes, ding, ding, yes, ding. They know. So that I think was the best comment in the whole video. And that was the end. So they basically warned about the whole thing. They saw the whole damn thing coming, and raised the alarm. And now we've got to work to get out of it. So, but it's cool that people know what's going on. Some of this stuff is predictable.
Yeah, it's a fascinating view of the future from the past,
the fascinating view of the present, really.
Yeah, I don't know what the lesson we can take from this is.
I think one of the lessons is that there are forecasting is possible if they did a pretty good job, but not completely. I think another lesson is that you never know which companies are going to do what. In the end, that's the hardest part, to predict which specific company is going to get into which thing. And I think the further lesson is, yeah, the story is not done. Now we get to create the rest of the story over the next 15 years, which could be very different than the last 15.
To be seen.
Those are my three takeaways.
To be seen.
All right. Great. Any last thoughts on today's episode?
It's very, behind the band kind of story here, but apparently one of the inspirations for this project when they were creating it was a massive multiplayer online video game, Ultima Online, and the way in which the users interacted with the environment to change the environment, and how that changed environment affected the other users, and how that influences journalism. So I think it's kind of cool that something completely separate from news and politics and current events influence them in this way, that we've certainly gamified the entire world around us,
I've been a part of that.
See social media exhibit A.
It is very fascinating. It
certainly feels like we're trying to fight our way out of a dungeon on some days.
Yeah, yeah, but. Hey, we did it. We created this amazing world. Aaron,
hooray!
Thanks for coming on the show today.
Pleasure as always.
All right. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. To support The Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week.
Feel the power.